Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The University of Tulsa Presidential Lecture Series gets underway tomorrow evening with humorous and political satirist P.J. O'Rourke speaking in a free lecture tomorrow night at the Reynolds Center at 7:30. O'Rourke is the author of 17 books, including the bestsellers Parliament of Horrors, Holidays in Hell, Give War a Chance, and Don't Vote, It Only Encourages the Bastards. O'Rourke was a former managing editor of the National Lampoon magazine in the 1970s during that magazine's heyday, later served on the foreign affairs desk at Rolling Stone for 20 years and freelance for Playboy and Vanity Fair. Today he's a fellow at the Cato Institute and a correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly and the Weekly Standard. You can also hear him as a frequent panelist on NPR's quiz show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. He's also the author of a forthcoming book later this fall titled The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault. O'Rourke will be lecturing tomorrow night at the University of Tulsa's Presidential Lecture at the Reynolds Center at 7:30, and he joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. P.J. O'Rourke, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us. We're looking forward to your appearance at the Presidential Lecture.
Well, you're welcome, and I'm looking forward to it, too.
I would imagine you'll be talking a little bit about the subject of your forthcoming book, which is looking at the baby boom. And from what I can see, you don't have a whole lot to say about your generation and my generation.
Well, you know, funnily enough, in the end, I kind of came around to liking us. I don't know if I'd go so far as to say I came around to liking myself personally, but I decided in the end that baby boom, while it's very silly, self-indulgent, spoiled, and self-involved, and all of that, that when it comes to doing human harm, that we actually have a better track record than previous generations.
How would you describe that?
Well, it's, you know, a little bit like having Bozo the Clown in the White House, and golly, we've tried. But I was just thinking about just the sheer number of Americans who died when the greatest generation was in charge of the world, which would be, say, through the Vietnam War, certainly. There were seven guys I knew from high school and college that got killed in Vietnam. Some 50,000 people died. And then when you have the generation that came before the greatest generation, which I think of as the idiot generation, well, then you've got, like, World War II and Korea on their hands. And you know, you get around to us, and, you know, the military actions, I mean, not to, you don't want to make light of this, I mean, every death is a, every person's irreplaceable, but the death toll with our military operations has been far, far more limited, and we weren't just, like, dragging the streets with a net, grabbing everybody who couldn't wiggle out of it. You know, the people we've got in our armed forces now are there on purpose, and it shows. They're a lot better.
A lot of people would say that a volunteer force allows us to do more of those sorts of things rather than having to have a draft where everybody has a full debate on whether it's good to go to war or not.
Although, you know, the way we slipped and slid into Vietnam, I don't remember that there ever was really...
There was never a vote on that, was there?
That kind of debate that we're talking about here, you know, we just sort of like seemed to slide downhill into that one. Whoops, this grass is slippery. It kind of crept up on us. Well, I mean, I suppose quantitatively we do more of these things. I mean, there have been more of, you know, but the size of what we do has been much, much more limited. But then I was also thinking about a lot of other things. I mean, the economy has grown terrifically while the baby boom, I kind of think of the baby boom as being in charge from about the late 70s on. I guess I got to back up here for one moment because I think it's important for people to understand the baby boom has an actual mathematical definition. It's not just a vague term. Like the greatest generation is anybody who was old enough to have maybe fought in World War II, whether they did or didn't. Baby boom is actually 1946 through 1964, and it's a statistical thing. It's when the American fertility rate exceeded the long-term American fertility rate for those specific years, starting 1946 when all dads got home from being kind of lonely overseas until moms all got the pill.
Well, one of the things I read, it was pretty interesting that you had in a piece recently, you were talking about when we think of baby boomers having cultural influence, it's on music. Then you point out, it said, you know, by that technical definition that you mentioned, all the people who created the great music of the 60s and early 70s were not boomers.
Almost all of them were born before 1946. Beatles and the Rolling Stones, just to begin with. I said, so, you know, we're not the generation of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones or even the Kinks. We're the generation of Grand Funk Railroad. In many ways, the baby boom, you know, we sort of get blamed for the 60s because we were, you know, out and dressing funny and making noises during the 60s. But in fact, we were the tailgate party, not the team on the field. If you look back to where the leadership was in the 60s, even like, you know, Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn, or Timothy Leary, or Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, all these people were pre-baby boomers. And once the baby boom reached the age of reason and the draft was eliminated and herpes began to manifest itself, we all snapped right out of it.
I always remember something Calvin Trillin said, you know, said America was governed by the generation prior to that 1930s, the Depression era children. They were always governed by people from a generation before that, born in the teens and 20s. And then
right.
We switched right over to the baby boomers. He goes, our only chance at governing was Michael Dukakis.
That, you know, he's so completely right about that. There's never been a silent generation, what you call the people between the greatest generation and the baby boom, the silent generation. There's never been a silent generation president. You can kind of technically count Jimmy Carter, who's old enough to have been the greatest generation, but actually didn't get out of Annapolis until 1946. So if you want to technically count, and so I always say, you know, like, all right, we've had some baby boom presidents that were, give each president the road trip test. Road trip with Bill Clinton, him running off the road every time a pedestrian with breasts appeared, that could be nerve-wracking. Road trip with George W. Bush might not have been bad before he gave up beer. Probably be a little dull now. Road trip with Barack Obama. I can sort of see Barack Obama arguing with the GPS. This is a debate I want to have. You know? But then think about a road trip with Jimmy Carter. Whoa! Always stopping off to hammer on poor people's houses as if poor people didn't have enough troubles already.
When you were talking earlier about the boomers, you said that things the boomers didn't do so bad, the economy. Now, I think you'll get a lot of debate about that, but certainly the economy did boom when baby boomers switched from partying to making money.
It did. You know, now it's been a messy boom, and there have been a lot of aftershocks in between the booms. But, you know, this is because of innovation. I mean, the baby boom has been remarkably innovative and, you know, into all this electronic stuff that didn't exist just a few years ago. This is all a product of the baby boom. You know, the fundamental technology behind the tech revolution is a baby boom thing. Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, these are baby boom guys. And, of course, any tremendous innovation like this also causes tremendous disruption, you know. The Industrial Revolution has certainly been good for the world. I mean, the world is much, much richer and better off because of the Industrial Revolution, but that didn't mean it didn't come with its price. Dark satanic mills, as the poet Blake put it.
Mm-hmm.
Smog and all the rest of that. So the innovations of the baby boom have caused a lot of disruption. I mean, you're talking to a print journalist here.
That's right. An endangered species.
No kidding. You know, for 40 years I was a writer, and now I'm a content provider, and the message of the internet is content is free. So I'm not entirely happy about it. But nonetheless, it is a period of remarkable innovation, and in the long haul, human beings, you know, we're already better off for it.
I was reading a little excerpt from the book, and you actually write about monopoly as sort of a primer on how the baby boomers operated once they had the levers on the economy. It's very fascinating because the latest version of Monopoly basically got rid of
Amazon.
That's right. Well, it got rid of jail. It got rid of jail, which is
invented. The baby boom invented selling get out of jail free cards to the highest bidder.
Your own rules. You said you wrote that they make up their own rules because the rules are far too complicated. So you make
that's
up your...
it. That's it. We played Monopoly a lot when I was a kid in the 50s, and you know, it comes with this rule book that's like the size of the old Manhattan phone book when there was a phone book. And so you kind of despair of that and you make up your own rules. And I said, you know, this is where, like, modern Fed policy and derivatives markets and, like, all that goes on Wall Street, it all comes from too many rainy days when we were playing Monopoly back in the 50s. So there may be an upside to climate change.
My guest today is P.J. O'Rourke, author of numerous books, a journalist and essayist. His books include Holidays in Hell, Parliament of Whores, Give War a Chance, Don't Vote, and a new book that's forthcoming called The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault. And he'll be giving a University of Tulsa presidential lecture, kicking off that series tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Reynolds Center. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You've been a longtime libertarian conservative. I wanted to ask you, you know, when you first started writing political commentary and the like, you were sort of on the humorous fringe, and now you've watched that fringe sort of take over the mainstream. Do you sense that in any sense yourself?
Yeah, I do, and I don't think it's necessarily a good thing. I really don't. I always felt that, humorous are... Well, basically, we're the kids. We're standing in the flower garden, pressing our noses against the dining room window, and making funny faces at the grown-ups inside eating dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And one of these days, you realize, I'm getting a little tall. I really ought to be inside carving the turkey. And so I'm not impressed with myself as a humorist, and I'm not impressed with the sort of dominance of humor. Yes, humor is a good way to get across some difficult points with in a sort of, in a way that could lead to getting punched in the nose if you were to be dreadfully serious about it. It's got its place, but I think it's sort of gotten, people say, well, do you watch Colbert? And I go, well, I know enough fake conservatives already. Why would I watch Colbert?
Well, I was also thinking about the Tea Party, too, which, as you mentioned, says they do approach just in deadly earnestness. And, it seems a little out there. I mean, it's almost sometimes with comic hyperbole that a libertarian humorist as yourself would put out there.
It does. Yeah. I mean, they do sometimes make you wonder if they aren't kidding. I always try and tongue. I'm pretty much on the page with a lot of the Tea Party. There's a kind of anti-immigrant side to the Tea Party, some of the Tea Party folks that I don't quite go along with, because we are, after all, a nation of you-know-whats. And I mean, you can get as anti-immigrant as you want, as far as I'm concerned, as long as you're a Sioux Indian. The rest of us are a little on shaky ground on the immigrant thing. But, yeah, my feeling with them has always been, look, lighten up a little bit here, But lightening up a little bit and making your points with a good sense of humor, the way Ronald Reagan famously did, is different from just making everything a joke. And I speak as a guy who makes everything a joke. So I'm not kidding here.
Well, let me ask you about the recent events, like gridlock's been going on. Really, the parties are at loggerheads. As a libertarian, is that perhaps the best situation for somebody of your political philosophy?
There are certainly a lot of libertarians who argue that deadlock's what we want because that way nothing gets done, and most of the things that get done are all wrong. I'm not sure I go quite that far. I think we're in deadlock because we're split as a nation about 50-50 on a lot of issues. You can just look at the polls and... we really kind of like to have all the social benefits that the European welfare states have. But on the other hand, we know that if we did that, we'd pay for it with growth and opportunity, the way the European nations have. So we're caught on the horns of a dilemma. And I think that the political deadlock in Washington accurately reflects a sort of philosophical deadlock that the American people are in. They'll work it out. We'll work it out. People say, Oh, we're so polarized now. And I said, I'm a child of the 60s. I always remember, cops chasing me with tear gas. I'm not seeing that today, save for an occasional
Occupy Wall Street
demonstration. And I said, you polarize. What about 1861? That was polarized,
Well, I was reading an excerpt from your book, Don't Vote, and... it was really interesting. You had some very interesting comments about redistribution because, you said, it doesn't matter if you're conservative or liberal, you're still going to have some redistribution. It's just what you're going to fight over. How much?
how much and of what kind. Yeah, every society practices redistribution. I mean, what is the root of all social organization is the family, and the family is, speaking as a working dad, with stay-at-home wife and three kids, there is redistribution. You know, I do not get to keep all the money. And not that there's that much coming in now that I'm a content provider, but you know what I mean. Quite a bit of it. I would say, in fact, all of it. In fact, some years, more than all of it, it's redistributed.
You had a good philosophy about it. It says, never do for a stranger what you wouldn't do for your bum brother-in-law.
Well, that's at the core of, I think, of all good welfare policy, is to first make the realization that we all know from personal experience that people are hard to help. We have all got friends, we've all got relatives, some of us have got kids, and some of us have got parents that need help, and it ain't easy giving it to them. And are they grateful when we do? Are they grateful for the intervention, for the 90 days at rehab? No, they're not. So first realize that people are darn hard to help, and then realize that, you know, how carefully you have to go about helping them. You know, if you got the drunk brother-in-law, and I don't, incidentally, one of my brother-in-laws is deceased, and the other's perfectly respectable retired dental researcher. But if you have a drunk brother-in-law, you can't just give him money, because he'll go get drunk, you know. But then how do you help him, you know? And so, yes, that's, you know, we're never going to get to the end of that argument any more in the nation any more than in our own families and friendships.
My guest today is P.J. O'Rourke, author of numerous books, journalist and essayist. His new book is The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault. You can hear
and I'll
him,
never do it again.
And you can hear him frequently on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. He'll be giving a University of Tulsa presidential lecture tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Reynolds Center. Well, we'll talk about your being on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. That means you have to be a very avid consumer of the news, at least to know what's
that
going
week.
On. To make fun of it.
That week. I'm not on every week.
Yeah, right. Tell me about your consumption of news.
It's spotty, and especially in the summertime, because I would really rather not know. Unfortunately, over the past week or so, it's been sort of unavoidable with this Syria thing. This is like one of the strangest things I've ever seen in my entire life, and I don't have a strong position on intervention with Syria. I mean, that's kind of like there's a hornet's nest, you know. Do we kick it? Do we get up real close and see what the hornets are doing? Poke it with a long stick? It's not that I don't know, but the amazing indecisiveness of our president, it's like, you know, he's like crossing a Rubicon, but brr, that water's kind of chilly, and looks deep, too. So I'm going to walk down the riverbank here for a ways and look for a bridge, but I'm crossing Rubicon as soon as the weather warms up.
I think there are a lot of people ambivalent about Syria, because I think we're tired of ongoing conflicts.
One's not going to stop just because we drop a couple bombs on it.
And yet chemical weapons... You know, that when we start using weapons of mass destruction, that's something we said never again to.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it really is a difficult conundrum, and being publicly indecisive about it is not helpful. You know, I thought it was going to happen over Labor Day weekend. I thought, well, this is just like the Obama administration to pull something like this over Labor Day weekend, hope nobody notices, you know. One thing for George W. Bush, you know, maybe he was right, maybe he was wrong, but he did it at high noon in time for the evening news on a weekday, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to face the fact we are the only superpower in the world. Nobody else is willing to take up being a superpower except maybe the Chinese, and I'm not sure that's a great idea. And, you know, it does come down to us, and we've got the memory of things like Rwanda when we failed to act. More and more as I get older, I'll say to myself, boy, I'm glad I'm not the person that has to make these decisions.
Exactly.
Unfortunately, well, I'm afraid our president, who is elected to make these kind of decisions, is saying that to himself right now. See if I can kick this can down Pennsylvania Avenue.
Well, now, as a principled libertarian, he's asking Congress for approval of this. That's probably, from a libertarian point of view, that's probably a good thing, because... You know, a unilateral executive is usually a bad thing.
I think so, yeah. No, I do think asking Congress is the right thing to do, except it should have been happened 6 months ago. You know, not when the crisis comes, you know. I mean, that should have been a preparatory thing, you know, that he should not have laid down this red line before he, you know, knew that he was going to be able to enforce it, and that would have meant a prior discussion or he went to Congress and said, look, you know, we don't want to get involved in this thing, but if they do X, Y, or Z, we're going to need to do something, and I want to make sure you guys are with me on this.
Earlier we were talking about Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. How do you prepare for an appearance on that show? I mean, it's a lot of fun.
I just read the newspaper for a change, you know, and like hit the Drudge Report. And, you know, so
Drudge Report. Yeah.
And of course, a lot of the stuff that they, you know, I kind of fiddle around on the internet because a lot of the more obscure questions that they'll ask the panel on there come from just that, because that's what they do. The staff, Peter Sagal and all the people who write and work on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me spend all week on the internet looking for, you know, stories about snakes and toilets.
Right.
So you got to be up on your snakes and toilets.
Well, and I assume at the same time you're reading about these events, you're sort of formulating how you're going to make it funny, too. Or is it a matter of I'm just going to wing it and see what happens?
Yeah.
I would think that would be a bad idea.
Well, you know, it's sort of hard to tell. It's funny the way the show comes together. You go in with a certain number of jokes that you're going to make about the news that week. And then it turns out Peter Sagal's already thought of those jokes, and he gets them out before you have a chance. Or it just the subject never comes around, and so you do have to sort of think on your feet. And some of the funniest things that have happened on the show have been totally spontaneous. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, people just pop out with stuff. And that, you know, it's kind of what we're paid. And, of course, it's NPR, so it's not like we're paid a ton. It's what we get the free tote bags for.
That's right. The tote bags don't carry all the money away?
Yeah. No, the tote bags are not very useful for carrying all the money away.
That
you could do with a very small envelope.
You know, as you've written about your life, you know, you had a transformation when you went from being a liberal during your college days and right after college to becoming a very principled conservative and libertarian. I'm wondering if anything has changed your eye over the last few years. I know you wrote quite a bit about the financial meltdown and what happened and sort of, I think you wrote at the time, said, you know, I'm having second thoughts about not regulating things, but then I realized that a penny costs 2 cents to make, and that restored my lack of faith in government.
Yes, you gotta keep hold of your lack of faith in government, especially when you're on Medicare like I am, you know.
Well, really, did anything give you pause?
Well, sure, you know, I mean, you do begin to realize, you know, as you get older, that all pure political ideologies lead to nasty behavior, you know. I mean, it's like having too detailed a set of household rules, you know. I mean, if the kid is going to get the same punishment for tracking mud into the kitchen as she gets for wrecking the car, you know, it's just not going to be a happy household, you know. And so you realize that, you know, the whole political process is a fluid, the whole democratic process is a fluid and messy one that's never going to be perfect. And you know, we all should have learned this at some point back in kindergarten or something, that don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, you know. So I tend to shy away. I mean, I'm a libertarian with a small L, you know, and I'm a conservative with a small C, and I'd be a Republican with a small R if I could figure out how to do it.
Well, getting back to your book, The Baby Boom, I read an essay not too long ago, and it was a very, very touching essay, and was talking about how we've diminished as an American identity, and getting back to the idea of the baby boom. And you said, you know, we used to have the biggest buildings. We built the biggest ships. We built the highest and longest bridges across, you know, the Golden Gate, suspension bridges. And we don't do that very much. We make the biggest military weapons.
Most Twitter feeds.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is a little something to be said, and I think it can be said against the baby boom, that we lost a little bit of that sense of American exceptionalism. and which we should probably try and get back to a little bit, because we are a truly exceptional country. And of course, one of the reasons that we lost a little of that sense of American exceptionalism is actually it's a nice reason. I mean, in the wake of World War II, when I was a little boy, there was one country left standing on the globe. I mean, every other country was either dirt poor or had been devastated by war, or in many, many cases, both. And it was just us. We were the only prosperous democracy in the world, and one of the very few democracies in the world. Well, there are a lot more democracies now, and there are a lot more prosperous countries, and quite a few sort of up-and-coming, getting there, kind of lower-middle-class countries, but striving, you know. And the world actually is a better place than it was 65 years ago when I was born. And if that's what makes America less exceptional, that's not such a bad thing, you know. But we should remember that we still are, you know, the most powerful, and in many ways the most free, and certainly the most responsible society on Earth, and let's not let loose of that.
I was also struck by something else you wrote. You said that despite all these issues that are going on with imperfect democracies, and oftentimes we say things like, are they ready for democracy? You say, hey, let's look at our own roots.
Yeah, really.
We were not necessarily ready for democracy when the founding fathers came over.
No. People have to figure this stuff out on their own, but there's no such thing. You know, are people ready for democracy? That's like asking, you know, are people ready for food? You know, are people ready for shelter? You know, are people ready for being treated decently by other people? You know, and yet, at the same time, there are societies, we're watching over in Egypt, there are societies where there are some impediments to democracy that are pretty darn big. But then we had half of our country at one time, didn't we?
That's right.
It had a pretty big impediment to democracy, known as slavery, you know, and it wasn't pretty, but we did manage to get that straightened out.
That's right. Only land-owning white males voted originally in our country.
That's right. That's right. And as a matter of fact, I mean, it had to be, it couldn't just be itty-bitty patch of land, you know, it had to be a certain amount, you know, enough to pay taxes on. So, you know, it took us a long time to get this. Some would say we're still working at it. So we got 200 and however many years, you know, that we've been dealing with this.
Yes.
And then we expect the Tunisians to just like snap their fingers and have a House of Representatives.
A more perfect union, yes, exactly.
A more perfect union, yeah.
All right. Well, we look forward to your lecture in Tulsa, PJ. PJ O'Rourke, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Humorist and political satirist PJ O'Rourke speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He'll be the first lecturer in the University of Tulsa's Presidential Lecture Series, which gets underway tomorrow evening at 7:30 in a free lecture at the Reynolds Center. He's also the author of the forthcoming book, his 18th overall, titled The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way and It Wasn't My Fault. It'll be released later this fall. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.